Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, hello, good friends. Welcome back to the Bill Press Pod, and welcome to the second installment of our four-part special series on choosing a president. And the big question we're asking is, what lessons can we learn from having picked 47 presidents so far that help us make the right choice in 2024? And again, I know most of you listening have already made up your mind. You know that I have. But we still think this is very, very important. For one thing, just to remind us how far out of line Donald Trump is with every one of our former presidents, Republican or Democrat, just way, way out there, totally unfit for the office and unthinkable that he would ever get back close to the White House. So it's a good reminder for us, and it gives us some ammunition to talk to our friends and make sure that they don't sit this election out or don't take it for granted. That's why we're doing this. And again, our guide along the way is the renowned presidential historian Douglas Brinkley, professor of history at Rice University, who studied all of our presidents in depth and written books about several of them. We kicked off our series with Doug Brinkley last week, examining what qualities we should be looking for in any candidate for president. What's the magic mix? And today we asked Professor Brinkley to walk us through the ranks of those who've actually served in the Oval Office. Who were the great ones or not so great? What made them great? What they accomplished, or how they united and inspired the nation? And what's more important, domestic policy or foreign policy? And then again, we'll circle back to how all of this relates to Joe Biden and Donald Trump. Professor Brinkley, good to have you back here on the Bill Press Pod. Thanks so much, Doug. Good to talk to you again.
I love talking with you, Bill. Thanks for having me.
So last week we talked about what it takes to run and what qualities we ought to be looking for in any candidate running for president. So this week, Doug, I'd like to take a look with you at some of those who have held the office and what lessons we might learn from them. I'm just an amateur presidential historian following in the tracks of people like you, but from what I've read, it seems most people believe that Washington, Lincoln, and FDR were the greatest. You know, our friend Richard Norton Smith calls them the holy trinity of all presidents. Do you agree, and kind of what makes them so great?
I completely agree. And I would really put FDR up very high. He was unbelievable. Washington, the very fact of the matter, the first of anything, he had to trendset. He had to establish the institutions of our government. He had to balance the different sides. We saw when Washington's out of the picture in 1800, we have our most brutal of early elections when our political party system is created with John Adams, Federalist, against Thomas Jefferson, Democrat, Republican, and became just deeply ugly. You know, I mean, our Constitution does not call for political parties. So Washington trendsetted Seth the First and, you know, kept America. His only real executive order was Neutrality Act to try to keep the United States out of European civil wars and give ourselves a chance to do westward expansion, but also to build our nation in general.
And FDR surpassing all the rest, you think?
I put Lincoln first, FDR second, and third, Washington. The FDR reasons are he won four times. So when you deal with presidential history, you're, you know, have a 13 years of study. I think he invented the modern America. his determination to electrify the nation, to make sure that we were building our highways and roads equipped so we could have military trucks for World War II. His caring about the so-called forgotten person, you know, his driving around rural South and all over the country in his car, even though he couldn't walk and talk to people. And, you know, it's the most innovative government you've ever imagined with FDR. I'm in awe wherever I go and I see a mural in a post office painted, you know, during the New Deal, or read a guidebook or see photographs of our country. And then it's hard to argue with his leadership in World War II, at least up till Yalta. I think when Yalta in early 1945 comes in, Roosevelt was very ill, sick, probably should have had those meetings transcribed. We didn't have a record. He didn't keep Truman in engaged. So you can start criticizing FDR, but up till then, his run winning four presidential elections, it's quite astounding. And Abraham Lincoln, of course, you know, he wasn't even on the ballot in the southern states. He had nothing near a plurality of American people behind him. He had to be snuck in from Illinois with a body double into the executive mansion. And we go in modern parlance or thinking, I mean, the Dulles Airport is where the first Battle of Bull Run took place and the Confederates won. So imagine you're sitting in the executive mansion and the Confederates just win Bull Run and Maryland's a hotbed of secession. And there's Lincoln having to reunite the country, and the fact that he does it. And he adds all of these new foundational texts to our country. Our real foundational texts are the Bill of Rights, Declaration of Independence, Constitution, maybe the Northwest Ordinance. And then you get Lincoln's first inaugural and the Gettysburg Address and Emancipation Proclamation. And really the idea of presidential power as we think of it today emanates out of the emancipation of the slaves. And so, you know, Lincoln is just the ultimate giant. And no matter how badly somebody has it in the White House, no matter if Donald Trump's complaining about his impeachment or Biden doesn't like that people are saying he's too old, Lincoln had it worse. And no president had what Lincoln had trying to cobble back together the United States. And that he was successful means he's George W. Bush's hero, he's Barack Obama's ultimate hero, and even, you know, Joe Biden now likes to behave as if he's the indispensable Lincolnian man of democracy right now.
So look at the three of them: the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, and World War II. Right? How is that the ultimate test for the president, that they passed and then catapults him into the top three? How important is that war factor, I guess, as I'm asking?
Great question, Bill. I think it's extremely important. You know, that's what I was mentioning to you in a previous time, that the importance of our times, the times the president's in. Do you meet the moment? Theodore Roosevelt actually would have loved to have had a war. he was president 1901 to 1909 in his rank.
He tried hard. He tried hard, right?
But you know, he ended up, fate had him winning a Nobel Prize for the Japanese-Russian war negotiation. And fate had him known for conservation of our public lands. You know, fate had him as the president of the Panama Canal, but not a big war. And you know, but that is what T.R. knew as a student of history, which he was a good one, is that that's where presidential greatness usually comes in, when you're there at this deep and troubled time. Now, if you look at Joe Biden right now, nobody would think of him as one of the great presidents. However, if Biden beats Trump two times, we might be living in the age of Joe Biden, not the age of Trump. Even though media coverage has been so dominated by Trump, Biden may be able to come out as a Truman-like figure that was necessary for our times. If he loses to Trump, he will be seen as a classic example of staying on too long in Washington, of not stepping down, of putting himself above our democracy. So I think in Biden's case, his entire legacy is hinged on winning or not winning.
You've mentioned Teddy Roosevelt a couple of times. I know he's a favorite of yours. You've written a great book about him, The Wilderness Champion. And I want to talk about environment a little bit later. But just in terms of Teddy, he really expanded the powers of the presidency, didn't he? I mean, transformed the presidency just by being he's who he is, I guess.
Theodore Roosevelt, you know, here's the thing, Bill. In our Constitution, we don't give presidents very much power. In fact, we don't have such a thing called executive orders in our country. Now, Washington does one for the Neutrality Act, but barely, if any, a president will use one executive order for something, and that's rare. Lincoln, then, with the slavery, that's rare. Some people call it executive order number one, the emancipation. TR comes in, and he's just signing executive order after executive order. He's defying Congress. For example, they wanted to mine the Senate, the Grand Canyon, for zinc, asbestos, and copper, and Roosevelt can't get it in as a national park, so he takes an executive order and declares it one and gets sued, goes to court, and wins. Once TR starts it, by FDR's doing like 3,700 executive orders. You know, things in your lifetime are done by executive orders, like, you know, the Peace Corps by Kennedy was an executive order. We tend to expect presidents to do that, use it in their toolkit, but it's not in the Constitution. It's just become kind of a tradition that we do it, and it's never as firm of holding as something that goes through Congress. Biden could sign a huge executive order today. It will get challenged in the courts. He may lose, and then the executive order never happened. And so we still need to put forward legislation because that's what sticks.
Right. And the Panama Canal, I guess, is another example, right, of Teddy Roosevelt. Maybe people you don't have the power to do that, but he did it anyway.
Exactly. And he found a way to use it by... A modern-day Panama was simply a province of the country of Colombia, and they didn't want us there, Colombia. So we helped incite a little revolution in Panama. And the flag of Panama was designed at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York, and we then were able to go in on this new country of Panama and actually claim not only the canal but the canal zone on each side of it, in a kind of imperialistic way. But it was a imperative from TR's mind. He was a student of Alfred Thayer Mahan, who believed in sea power, and TR was determined that our East Coast Navy could meet the West Coast Navy, and the canal offered all of that for the military, plus all the cargo ships. So he did it, and we honor it, and people think it's great. What Roosevelt, TR, understood better than any president is how to sell people on things using optimism, and then I would put the word can-doism. Americans like to believe we can do anything. You know, that's why Kennedy mattered when he said we could put a man to the moon by the end of the decade. If we never went to the moon, it would be a flat tire. But by 1969, when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin are on the moon and come home, it's American exceptionalism. It's American can-doism. And right now, we're not having that. We don't know where American can-doism is coming from. It seems to be the private sector. People like Elon Musk shop it, or Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos, but we're not feeling it at a writ large in a presidential sense.
No. But it is one theme, I have to say, that President Biden does use. He used it at the end of his State of Union address, right? That there's nothing, I've heard him say so many times, there's nothing we cannot do, right, if we work together.
There you go. I mean, that's the core of what America is. The question is, are people buying into that anymore?
Got it, right.
Or is that corroded? Is he the best person to sell that message? But that has been the glue that's held our country together. We like to believe in our own uniqueness, and there's no democracy like us. And I still believe Biden's right to do that. And I think we have to believe in our country in that way. But we're in troubled waters right now.
agree with his policies or not, would you have to give Ronald Reagan credit for being one of those who did transform the presidency?
Reagan had something happen to him only weeks in office. He was a polarizing figure. Well, he had the benefit of the landslide in 1980. It really killed liberalism. And I mean, not just Jimmy Carter losing, but all the senators, George McGovern and Frank Church and, you know, Gaylord Nelson. The list is long. And then he was shot in March of 1981. And suddenly a lot of people were pulling for our president. They weren't thinking of him as a leader of the right. They were thinking of him as a wounded American president, and their prayers were with him. And Reagan pulled through, and he clung to his anti-communist belief. But at the same time, we're lucky in history, Nancy Reagan and Ronald Reagan believed in George Shultz, who was the Secretary of State. And Shultz was a centrist who believed in NATO, believed in negotiation, a very sane man who died recently, spent his ex-Washington years trying to do away with nuclear weapons. That's George Shultz. And that's who Reagan listened to on foreign policy, and it mattered. And I think the diplomacy with Reagan and Gorbachev is epic stuff. And so by the end of his two terms, the economy was doing well, and the world was a safer place due to nuclear arms reductions. And so, he's situated nicely in history.
Right. How's the job of president changed in your judgment and that you've learned again by looking at how all the presidents have performed? I mean, it's a different job today than it was even 20 or 30 years ago today, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, the big change is transportation. You're expected to be everywhere as president now. If there's a school shooting, you better be there to be the grief counselor at the service.
Yeah.
If there's a tornado going somewhere, you better go or you're going to be called lazy not going. Biden got beat up for not going to East Palestine, Ohio, or going to Hawaii quickly enough during the fires. We expect them to get on that Air Force One and hopscotch around the country. And in campaigning, I mean, how quaint it was. I mean, William McKinley at the beginning of the 20th century never left his home in Canton, Ohio. We call it, the front porch campaign.
The front porch, right.
You had to come to him. You didn't have to go shake hands and all over the place. But due to modern aviation, we now really expect presidents to be everywhere all the time. So you're on the go a lot. Then a communications revolution, Bill, when you were doing, Crossfire, that was cutting edge CNN back then, now cable's fading and there are all these new ways with podcasts and online presence, and social media, blogs, just people communicate differently. And so presidents have to stay up on top of the newest of new technological communication devices. Kennedy did that when he was president. That's when you had Telstar, the first time a voice could travel on television from, let's say, the U.S. to Europe. And you remember Barack Obama ran, and the symbol of his campaign was his BlackBerry.
Yeah, right.
It seems so ancient now. When Bill Clinton was president, he came in 1993, and nobody used email, nobody. And 8 years later, there are a billion emails going around the world, a minute. And we don't have a history of email. You don't go to the library. The technology is happening at such a rapid clip that we don't even understand how it's affecting our lives. And those are additional burdens to the president. And then they never get downtime. I mean, FDR, even we used to go in his car and shake the Secret Service and drive around lonely mountain roads by himself. That's in the 1940s. He could do that. Well, you can't do that anymore. We know where the president is every second. Everything's reported. Nothing seems off the record. Leaks are the mainstay of our time. And so it's a very different environment than it would have been 50 years ago.
And the president is not only expected to be everywhere, by the way, and like within 24 hours, right? if they give him that long. But the president is also blamed for everything, right? Price of eggs, it's Biden's fault, right? Or Trump's fault. Price of gas, a train derails, as you mentioned, in East Palestine. It's the president's fault, right? I mean,
exactly. There, so you get credit and blame for everything. And the problem with that is it does in its own slippery way lead to authoritarianism, because you start believing that one person has all of this power to do everything every minute. And by making the president this, you know, a very powerful figure that destiny is riding on, it's a short hop to a dictator, meaning we've lost that kind of town hall democracy, the feeling of local politics matter and getting out there. And it still exists, but it gets so overshadowed by the presidential front.
Right. So 47, we're in our 47th presidency. What can we learn from those who have held the job so far about whether it's even possible to serve as president of the United States today? Our guest again, American historian, one of the leading, if not the best American historian, Professor Douglas Brinkley from Rice University. And of course, you know him from CNN. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back on the Bill Press Pod and continue with Doug Brinkley. And today's podcast brought to you by the Laborers International Union of North America, or LIUNA, L-I-U-N-A, as they call themselves, under the leadership of President Brent Booker. The Laborers, they're the kind of the backbone of the American labor movement. They're involved, of course, in energy, old-fashioned energy like old-fashioned pipelines, but also new renewable energy like solar collectors and wind turbines. Also, of course, involved in the construction and a lot, millions of new jobs for the Laborers Union, thanks to the infrastructure bill signed by President Joe Biden. So we salute the members of the Laborers Union, thank them for their great work building America, and invite you to take a look at their website, liuna.org, L-I-U-N-A.org.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
And we're back on today's podcast, honored again to have with us Professor Douglas Brinkley from Rice University, American historian, author of many, many books on the presidency, including biographies of Jerry Ford and Teddy Roosevelt and Jimmy Carter. So, Doug, welcome back. And let me ask you, we haven't talked much about foreign policy. How big a part of the presidency is foreign affairs today?
I think it's the number one thing of a president. That's their...
Really?
Whoa. Yeah, I do. But the caveat is, Bill, it's not perceived as that come election time. Everybody has the belief it's about the economy and how are the voter feels about, is their life getting better or are things more expensive? But in foreign affairs, presidents have a wide latitude. And really, ever since Harry Truman, when we created a National Security Council in the White House and a National Security Advisor, in this case, you know, Jake Sullivan, they're able to look and respond to world events, you know, by the minute. And, you know, we are now in a, mired in, you know, tensions with China over Taiwan, the status of what's going to happen in the Ukraine, NATO alliance, gas in the Middle East prices, which does affect our economy, Israel-Gaza war. I mean, it's just a brutal foreign, you have to be in charge of world affairs. And most presidents tend to love that part of the job. They feel that that's, you know, that's made order for them because they look at Joe Biden. I mean, he was head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee because that's considered the top post in the Senate. And as president, handling the world writ large, meeting other world leaders, these are very major tasks that we demand of our president.
And something today that is, and you've written a lot about this, it's one of your passions, that is important for the presidency that was not years ago is certainly climate change and the environment. But you point out some presidents kind of were ahead of their time dealing with that.
Well, on environment and climate, you know, they're the only presidents that really understood conservation were Theodore Roosevelt and FDR. FDR used to put on every form his occupation was tree farmer. He
really?
He lived and born in the Hudson River, lived there, died there, and he grew far trees. And he was an avid bird watcher and cared deeply about the topography of America and the lands. FDR created 800 state parks, 800 during the New Deal in our country today. And TR saved 234 million acres of wild America. Both of them were very much into naturalist studies, the natural world. That's it. Jimmy Carter has a great propensity for the outdoor life. And as president, one of his most notable achievements he doesn't get credit for was the protecting of Alaska lands. As much land size of California were signed into national monuments and wildlife refuges by Jimmy Carter. But most presidents, it's just not their thing. I mean, Donald Trump, Joe Biden, Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, they all have records we can look at, but they weren't prioritizing the natural world as their earth science, as it's called today, as the top of their agenda. We will get a president that does that again. And that's when I think all of these grassroots climate movements will come together. On the issue of climate, Joe Biden has the best record with his, you know, Infrastructure Act. He folded a lot of climate legislation into that in a way that surpasses Barack Obama. So, you know, Biden's there, but he doesn't have that feel of the land. You know, we used to be a rural country and people understood soil and forest and the seasons. And now we're become so heavily urbanized that some of the issues of the hinterlands are neglected by presidents.
I must say, I was always struck by the contrast or almost in built-in contradiction in Theodore Roosevelt in that he did was into conservation, preserved so many lands, the first national park, right? Yellowstone, thanks to him. And yet at the same time, he was a big game hunter, right?
Well, Roosevelt, TR was Theodore Roosevelt, born in 1858 in New York. And the next year, 1859, became a revolution, beat only by the Bible. And that is Charles Darwin's On the Origins of Species. And people fighting at Antietam and Gettysburg weren't arguing about Darwin and evolution. But Theodore Roosevelt's father was the progenitor, fundraiser of the American Museum of Natural History in New York. And his father was an ardent Darwinian. and Theodore Roosevelt's uncle, Robert Barnwell Roosevelt, was the leading frog expert in America, who wrote a book on the waterfowl of Florida and the best book of his time on Lake Superior. So T.R. was raised in this world of John James Audubon and birds, and he decided to go to Harvard and major in what today would be wildlife biology. And he wrote his first book as an undergraduate called The Summer Birds of the Adirondacks. And he spent his entire life really loving it, but in the outdoors life and Darwin adventure of finding new flora and fauna. The rub that you're getting on is that in those days, to study species, you'd shoot them. There was no DNA. There was no, you know, bird banning yet. There were no ways to understand all these habits of our creatures. So you would shoot them and study beak variation or coloration. What's the difference between a crocodile and an alligator? Is a grizzly bear the same as a brown bear? You know, so he would go to places like Brazil and Africa collecting flora and fauna. And I detect a bloodlust in him. Yes, he did that for science, but he also enjoyed killing. So you have somebody who is a lifelong member of the Audubon Society and an Audubonner, and yet a lifetime member of the National Rifle Association.
Right. As I said, these internal contradictions, which are very interesting. So again, we come down to when we look at across the field of former presidents, the greats and the not so greats, we have a big choice to make today with between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. As you've talked about, Doug, Biden is sort of the old-fashioned president of I want to get things done. I want to get stuff done, right? I want to work together. And then you got Donald Trump, who's basically, I want to tear everything down, right? I mean, you couldn't have a greater contrast, could you, between the two?
Not. And Biden is very much in line with Truman, Eisenhower, Bush 41, Barack Obama. There's a straight line to Joe Biden. The disruptor, the chaotic agent, is Donald Trump, because he's fear-mongering, and that usually doesn't work. Now, it does work in movements. I mean, when we look at Donald Trump, we see perhaps more cunning than we expected. His ability to put a kind of whack-pack coalition together that's held up. By that, I mean he took the Strom Thurmond, George Wallace, segregationist, Dixiecrat types, people that are worried about the browning of America, and morphed them with that Ross Perot 19% about the sucking sound of your jobs or they're going to Mexico. Took pieces of things like FDR's lowest moment, Japanese internment, and Eisenhower's lowest moment as president with Operation Wetback, the deportation of people from Latin America, particularly Mexico. And he's cobbled all this stuff together. And there's a lot of Joe McCarthy there, the lawyer Roy Cohn, the Nixon. He believes that Nixon's mistake was admitting guilt in Watergate, that he should have never quit. You don't give up power, you stay. And so it goes. He's cobbled this together and has been able to defy logic. One would have thought at January 6th, that was the end of Trump's political career. He still would have been a factor in as a rabble rouser. But here he is running the grand old party of Abraham Lincoln, heading into the July 5th convention in Milwaukee. And that means he's a one-man revolution. If he gets reelected, knowing all of the things that he's done, knowing about the 91 indictments and the rest, and then still wins, it tells you we're a different country, and doesn't mean he will be seen in history as a large paradigm shifting figure in world affairs.
No, were he to be reelected, it would change the presidency forever, right? I mean,
it certainly seems like it would, unless he failed utterly on a second term, meaning you had, God forbid, a collapse of the stock market or a Great Depression and Trump gets blamed, or a war starts and Trump gets blamed. but it is the it's the turning of a very new page in our country, and it's back to a kind of belief in big powers, four or five. It's sort of the death of the United Nations world of it's going to put the big burden on Europe because Trump is not a friend of the European Union. And it
for
will
sure,
mean
right.
countries like Germany will have to really start doing their own self-defense. It's just a game shifting in every way imaginable. But I have to believe our country will survive and we'll go in different directions at different times. There's no telling what this the technological order we built, the damage that it can do to our country. There's no way to know where that ends. And yet it's what keeps you and I, Bill, alive till our 80s, you know, is new technological innovation. So it's an age where, you know, the big figures of our time are in the tech sector, and the whole world now is going to be dealing with, you know, AI and the yeah. like. And it's right. going so fast, we can't keep up with it.
It's for the good and the bad, right? I mean, the tremendous advances in technology and yet the disinformation that comes along with it. So final question, we say this every 4 years, but is it maybe more true than it's been in a while that this is the most important presidential election in our lifetime?
I've written so many books, Bill, on the presidents, and also yeah. I write for, you know, New York Times and places, and I've learned the power of qualifiers. So I often throw an adverb in there, you know, this is, likely right. will be the most. Yep. Mm-hmm. But in this case, I'm throwing away the qualifier. This is the most important election of our lifetime and one of the seminal moments in American history because of the stain of January 6th that Trump seems to me to be unfit for command. The thought that you're turning over the entire U.S. to somebody who wants to, you know, abolish entire parts of our government and do so in this feeling that you're above the law, that you're somehow believing what Nixon said, if the president does this, it's legal. That's a move into an authoritarian terrain that we haven't done before in our country. So we're in whole new order if Trump's inaugurated, you know, in January of 2025.
And that's a clarion call for everybody to get off their butt and get out to vote for sure. In fact, maybe even get involved in this election. Doug Brinkley, thank you again so much for your time. One thing we haven't yet talked about, which I'd like to do next time we get together, is the president's team. How important are the kind of people that he gets around him? Maybe even how important is the role of the first lady? We'll do that when we meet again, Doug Brinkley. Thank you for now, and have a great weekend.
Thank you, Bill.
And that's a wrap for our second sit-down with Professor Doug Brinkley about the American presidency. Are you convinced yet? I was before we started, but this is important information, friends, and thank you so much for being along with it, and I hope you're learning a lot as well as I am from someone who really knows the American presidency and shares our view that Donald Trump is totally unfit to be president of the United States. Next week, we'll go back and meet with Professor Brinkley, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important, how the team that a president puts together, the people he surrounds himself with, what can we learn from that? Who's done the best job? And of course, we'll take a look at some of the revolving door candidates in the Donald Trump presidency. That'll be next Tuesday, but we'll be back on Friday, as always, with our reporters roundtable to take a look at all the news of the week from Washington, D.C. and on the political scene around the country with three of Washington's top political reporters. That's Friday, the Reporters Roundtable. And then next week, next Tuesday, episode 3 with Professor Doug Brinkley on the American presidency.